Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Writer, performer, and professor Anna Deavere Smith says the U.S. is on the verge of a new civil rights movement, and she says the theater might help get people involved. In fact, that's one of the goals of her new work titled Notes from the Field, Doing Time in Education. It'll be put up by the American Repertory Theater at the Loeb Drama Center in Cambridge this month. Deavere Smith is well known for her roles on The West Wing and as Nurse Jackie. She's also received the 2013 National Humanities Medal from President Obama. Her plays have been called a new form of theater, usually a one-woman shows where Deavere Smith portrays several different characters reflecting on a social justice issue. This newest play focuses on education and mass incarceration. When we met with her yesterday at the Loeb in Harvard Square, we started by asking what sets this play apart from her previous theater work.
What's new is that I really feel that we should do more than just talk about how artistic institutions can be places for sharing ideas and even going further these days, talking about development of moral imagination and empathy and stuff like that. So I'm trying to think of ways that a theater or other kinds of, you know, concert halls, museums can be places where civic work can really be done. Where can we activate our imagination about our democracy? Is it just that we can only do it sitting on our couch watching CNN or the conventions? But when do we as a public get to talk, most importantly, with strangers? And I know there's some places like churches or guilds where these things happen. But even in that case, you know, you're more likely to be with somebody who shares a belief that you do. But I think one of the things that this particular election is showing us is we can't assume anything about beliefs in the United States of America. So we need to know more about one another. And that's with the theater. There's people, strangers in the audience. And so we're training people to host small group conversations. And what would normally be the second act, I'm given over to that enterprise. And the people are going to go off in small groups and talk about this matter of what's happened to our public school system and why it seems to be, for some kids, a kind of inroad to a life of incarceration. How do we stop what people call, some people call the school-to-prison pipeline, some people call it, which I don't think is really fair to blame teachers in schools. Some people call it the cradle-to-prison pipeline. Some people call it the womb-to-prison pipeline.
You know, some of these issues were really thrust into the national spotlight 2 years ago in
Yes.
Ferguson.
Oh, right? Okay. Ferguson is what really, really, really opened it up.
Right. Is this a new civil rights movement that we're witnessing right now? And is this what you want the theater to be part of?
Well, I would like to. I'm not sure if we're there yet. You know, a person who speaks about this matter much better than I, much more eloquently, is Sherrilyn Ifill, who is the head of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And she would say that we are probably in the midst of coming towards a civil rights movement, but she urges us not to simply make that about the criminal justice system, about mass incarceration. She doesn't think that we can really talk about that without talking about education. And what she points out is that's because this country is a country that makes big, big investments. We call it policy, but they're big investments. She says, you know, imagine there was a decision to invest in suburbs. So what happened? They made a whole interstate highway system to have that, right?
Right. You know what I
mean? The building of a middle class. She points out that black people were left out of these, you know, opportunities. But so we can do this. We can do this. And we made an investment in public schools, particularly in the late 40s and the 50s, Brown versus Board of Ed. But as we know, the South rebelled from that. And rather than doing what desegregation was meant to do, they made other private schools for their kids. So we look 6 years later and we kind of go, well, what happened?
So we need a new one. But we also had a black president for 8 years. What happened?
Martin Luther King, I wish I knew it by heart. I would love to be able to say it for you. It's actually one of the most extraordinary passages in Letter from a Birmingham Jail, where he talks about the need to show tension, that he's not afraid of tension, that it needs to be revealed. And the metaphor that he gives is like a sore that is full of pus or infection. It has to be opened to light and air to heal. And so I think that our president, who is really, in a way, as a black person, I'm proud to to identify him as black, but he's much more complicated than that in terms of what's underneath that black skin, as we know. White mother, raised by white people, father from Kenya, grew up all over the world, learned all about, you know, empathy and compassion as a young man. I like to think of him as something I heard Axelrod call him, as this splendid man. I think of President Obama as a splendid human being. And so it's almost like we needed this splendid human being who had already been a global citizen as a young boy. We needed this splendid person so that we, you know, it's what all our pus came forward in his presence. So people say, oh, it was post-racial. He was post-racial. The country was not. I mean, I've been so busy teaching very well-off, very talented people for 40 years. My mother was a school teacher. I grew up in de facto segregation. All my aunts were school teachers. All my mother's friends were school teachers. I watched them change lives. 2011, somebody gives me the opportunity to look at just how bad public school is. And I, where have I been?
But at the same time, you don't want to blame teachers necessarily. When you say that, are you talking really about school, or are you talking about the bigger cultural problems that are reflected in our schools, or both?
Well, yeah, you say it better than I could say it. Yeah, that's why we shouldn't blame teachers, because we're talking about a few generations of poverty and trauma. We're talking about a post-crack cocaine epidemic and new drug epidemics. We're talking about an over-medicated society anyway. There weren't guns in neighborhoods when I was a girl growing up in Baltimore. So to blame a teacher when we don't even take care of them, for part of my research, I went to Finland, and teachers are revered. They don't send special ed kids off and away. They're integrated in the classroom. They're not looked at like a pathological or a medical problem, looking like a pedagogical challenge. Teachers continue their research. I mean, that sounds like a really cool job to me, if you get to be coming to work every day as though you're not just delivering test scores, but you're really evolving and getting more support and the opportunity to ask more questions about the classroom. And in a place like Finland, as elsewhere in Europe, at a moment where these otherwise homogenous societies are changing a great deal because of migrations.
Right. I don't want to, you know, seem as if I'm Debbie Downer here. But what I'd like to ask you is, you know, where is theater right now in terms of the public conversation, and what obstacles does it face? Is it looked at almost as more of an elite kind of organization, and is it going to be difficult?
Yes, that is the case. But I have to expose my humility here. Then you get a hit like Hamilton, like a remarkable event that everybody would like to go to. They can't get in, no matter how much money they want to spend. And the first time I saw it, I thought, every kid in America needs to see this play, because it shows you that revolution, you know, it requires reading and writing and planning and talking and courage. And so I think we talk about this whole thing, you know, too generally. We would never talk about medicine that way, or money. It's kind of like the question over and over again from very smart people is, how can art make a difference? Can art make a difference? How can art make a difference? Can art, that, I don't even think that's the question anymore. I can't fill a stadium, but Jay-Z can. And, you know, we have to start where are. Wouldn't it be nice if all the sort of middle-class people, predominantly white, who come to my show, what if we said, you know, we'll give you a break if you bring somebody to the theater with you who's nothing like you. Can you find a kid? Bring a kid. Somebody that you work with, who you've never talked to, who's a different race, a different religion, bring them to the theater with you. I mean, we could do something about this other than continue to complain about the fact that it's all old white people.
And by
the way, I'm happy if any kind of color and any kind of age buys a ticket to my work, I have to say. You know, right. Grateful.
Yeah. For people who don't know, we should say that you do dozens of characters usually during a performance. I don't know how many in this particular one, and I'm told it's still a work in progress, mm-hmm. if you will. It's amazing to me to watch you, if I can say this, you become another person without any sort of outside aid. It's just your body, it's your voice, it's the way you do that. So I can imagine that must take an enormous amount of work,
and just, you know, it's the work of me learning the material, but it's also the work of us learning the communities. And it's my favorite part. In a way, it's me, I think, too, you know, solving a sort of crisis of having grown up in a de facto segregation. And it isn't just that, you know, well, don't go there, you can't come here, stop, no, not permitted. It's also as a sort of psychological survival mechanism. Many of us had to grow up thinking, well, don't even worry about those people over there. You know, what happens to you as a human? And so this project called Everything's Under This Umbrella on the Road of Search for American Character, which I started in the late 70s, it has helped me. My goal is to become America word for word. That's the kind of thing you think when you're 28. But it has helped me feel less strange. Mary Ellen Mark, the great, great American photographer, the late Mary Ellen Mark, writes in the preface to her book, American Odyssey, that the camera gave her the necessary distance to get close to strangers. And so I feel similarly that the tape recorder, imagine you do too, has given me the necessary distance that I need to get close to those people who are not like me at all. And that's really been my quest. I don't like feeling like I have to be in a tribe in order to feel psychologically safe and full and thorough and with an identity. I don't like that situation. And it's worse in the world now than it's ever been. People like to use words like empathy, compassion, moral imagination. And, you know, talk about the opposite of Debbie Downer. I guess you have to be Ursula Upper to even go there, Ursula Upper, up with people.
I like it.
but now, 4 years later, and watching what we've been watching in this country lately, I'm like, we got to get behind this. We got to get behind what would be called the soft stuff. Because laws can only take us so far. You know, desegregation. So what does the South do? As Sherrilyn Ifill says, you know, they closed the schools in Virginia for 5 years rather than in Prince Edward County, closed the schools for 5 years rather than integrate. And what concerns me is 60 years later, we just don't like each other. College campuses, you know, kids want to be in their tribes, you know, they have a problem just in terms of how student life tends to be. It doesn't matter what you teach in the classroom, of delivering to the world people who are willing to live together, be together, and should I use that other very dangerous word, love each other?
I wanted to ask you about go back to schools for a moment, because one thing that we've also seen in education is the presence of police officers in school. I believe at last check there are about 19,000 police officers stationed in schools across the country. Many folks say it's a different time now. We need those police officers. We've had lots of school shootings. We've learned over the decades that school can be a dangerous place, and those police officers keep the order. But I imagine that they could also contribute to the problem that you're drawing attention to in this piece. So what do you say to those folks?
Well, I've certainly been in environments where they are. You know, and I've heard both sides. You know, I've heard the people who say these kids are very disrespectful. They say, you know, well, guess we're going to have to call your mother. Call my mom. I mean, you and me, kid, I can't imagine nobody ever had to call my mother. Call my mom, right? And again, that's coming from someplace that is not about that, just about that school. That's coming from a lot of things that we can generalize about, you know, single moms, this, that. I'm not going to generalize because everything is very particular, that a child comes to school without the self-regulation that is required. Eaton, we can critique schools and say you shouldn't need so much self-regulation to learn and find the joy of learning and all that stuff. I think it's really, really unfortunate that we get to that place, that we are at that place, that they are there, that children have to go through metal detectors. You know, the fact that these children have to go to school, go through gates, go through, you know, or buildings that you can't even figure out how you get in. You know, every door is shut. What does that mean? And of course, yeah, sure. That's the, he's right there with handcuffs. What, you know, we don't have to imagine what's going to happen next.
Can you leave us with a little bit of a character telling people what you think this is all about? Who would you choose?
I don't know. Everybody's so, well, interdependent. I'll leave you with a person who's now dead, who died at 98, who I think has some real wisdom. She was a great philosopher of education, yet I found her so full of compassion and love for children, and her name is Maxine Green, and I think she gives us a historical context of why we are, in a way, where we are with schools in general. Maxine Green, and this is called Factories.
But the institution itself is modeled after the factory when it started, and I always tell people when they put clocks in classrooms and try to impose, like, clock time on children who grew up on farms, or, for example, to put the principal in an office, it makes you frightened to go. Or even I, when I go to a school and I stand at the clerks, I'm very nervous if they're busy. I don't know if I should say anything. And I know that they're liberating principals like Debbie, who has a group of five kids every morning and a teacher. And they talk. She's like, how can you have a school where you don't know that somebody died the night before? But it's all modeled after a factory with a boss and there are workers. It's linked to the acceptance of hierarchies. I can't stand that. And the only thing I can think, you know, is Thomas Jefferson, who's so admired, had a bill, one of the first bills for public education, and it had like schools. He said, out of the first 3 years, you'd have 10 kids, and out of the next three, you'd have more. But it was for excellence. It was a very meritocratic kind of thing. He said, you know, you choose the worthy ones, and you throw out the rubbish. And the rubbish were the poor kids who couldn't make it. Yeah, after you get the excellent ones who will appreciate our rational legislators. And when you think of the impact that those denials had, this great spokesman who had slaves and wouldn't let him go when he died, incredible. Oh, no, oh, no, 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 no. I can show you in his notes on the state of Virginia, you throw out the rubbish.
Can I clap?
Anna Deavere Smith is a writer, performer, and professor. The American Repertory Theater is putting up her newest work, Notes from the Field, Doing Time in Education, starting August 25th at the Loeb Drama Center. For more information, you can go to our website, radioboston.org. That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.